I want to pick up on what Sai was discussing yesterday, and that is the hedge fund environment, regulatory environment, and how you perceive it, that it is and risks are mitigated in this.
Yeah, I think about 5-6 years ago, hedge funds in South Africa went through a regulatory process. It's probably slightly longer than that. So we are regulated. We're highly regulated. For a number of those years afterwards, we felt a little bit cheated. We only had regulation, but no upside. In other words, the investors didn't flock to the asset class. All we had was extra admin and extra compliance and extra things to do. But I think thankfully, probably over the last 2 or 3 years, I think Sai, our company, and a couple of other hedge funds have been significantly more active in marketing hedge funds as an asset class. And I think there's no doubt that certainly over the last 2 years, we've started to see real traction. We've got retail funds available. They're unit trusts people can buy on daily liquidity. And we've actually seen real traction in hedge funds. So again, for the first time, we've got the regulation, but now we've got some upside. So and I think hedge funds are starting to come out of the shadows. I think they're becoming mainstream. A lot of financial services companies are understanding them and putting their clients in them. They understand the diversity. And I think it's, and again, if you look at the risk return profile, certainly the hedge funds, the big hedge funds in this country, show significantly lower volatility and higher returns than their peer group.
I love it that we're pulling a couple of the themes that we've discussed over the last 2 days together in this discussion. You mentioned, Pete, you mentioned the small cap arena and the mid cap exposure that you have. Can I ask you to be a little bit more specific without giving away any state secrets?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the small caps, we're still active. At the end of the day, we're a big fund, so we're still buying them. So we wouldn't want to talk specifically of those. I mean, maybe one we've had for a couple of years. I think Sai's got it all. It's Udeco, South African industrial engineering company, engineering spares, run with a very competent management team, probably on a 6.5 PE, 8-9% dividend yield now, doing share buybacks, understanding their business, still doing the odd acquisition if they find them cheap enough, and adding value. So, I mean, for me, it's those sort of companies that continue to eke out growth in a market that, quite frankly, hasn't grown for a few years, are great companies to be in.
You sat through the conversation with Jan Oberholzer, and I know you've done specific work around the state-owned entities in South Africa. Can you give us a sense from the research that you've done as to where we stand?
I think there's a lot of cause for optimism. I think that if we talk, for example, the Casile units, I know, for example, Sasol sent 3 or 4 of their top engineers to go and sit on that Casile site. When we were doing those 3 units, that was, quite frankly, the most important capital project in this country. We're talking about 2,400 megawatts that were out of service because of something, nothing to do with the turbines or the boilers. So I know that Sasol sent 3 top engineers there. They were welcomed by Eskom. They were embraced by Eskom. Their advice was taken by Eskom. And if you remember, those Casile units came on at least a month before the scheduled time. So it shows you what can be done if we bring in the private sector. And I think we're seeing a very similar thing now in Transnet. I think necessity sometimes trumps ideology. And I think we're seeing that at the moment. Now, what we've got to watch is and see is there real follow-through to this. Do they really want? Now, I remember a few years ago when I was doing a lot of work on Transnet, Porsche would bring in the private sector, particularly in a lot of their locomotives that were sitting idle. She got them to go through an audit of the locomotives, writing down what parts were needed, what was required, where to get it. And of course, the private sector then says, can we get these from you, get these for you, and can we put them in? And then the shutter kind of went down and said, no, you just leave that there, and we'll take it from here. So that's what you don't want to see. You want to see an embracing, like I think we are in Transnet at the moment. And I think, hats off, Michelle Phillips has been universally praised from everyone I've spoken to. We saw the Business Day article a few weeks before her appointment saying perhaps she's not black enough. And I think the reaction that certainly the private sector, including myself, sent to the government, definitely made it an influence. And I think for the first time they've listened. They put somebody who appears to be really competent in the job and happy to embrace the private sector. So those are the kind of small wins that
and it's that a, you want it's to a see. Refreshing view, because everybody is so down in the doldrums around SOEs. So it's great to hear that there is some upside.
I mean, Transnet is fixable. It, you know, we've been running trains in this country for 150 years. It's absolutely fixable. We had a collision on the coal line maybe 6 weeks ago. These trains don't even have proximity systems on them like mining trucks do. I mean, it's just, there are so many easy wins if we just open up and let the private sector get involved. And I think we're at that point now, because desperation is trumping ideology. They're saying, we need your help. And there's an argument that should companies be helping the government, or should they just stand back and let them flounder? But again, if we've got one coal export line, if you're a coal exporter, you can't sit back and watch this train wreck in slow motion, excuse the pun. You have to get involved. It is your bread and butter. It is your livelihood and the livelihood of your people as well.
That obviously feeds into your synopsis for South Africa. A minute ago, you said that the downside has been priced into stocks. Take it from
there. Yeah. I think we've just had so much negative news over the last couple of years. On a load shedding perspective, if we look at where we were this time last year, yes, we're not out the woods, but we're certainly better. And I think for any industrial company in South Africa, the difference between level 2 and 3 load shedding and level 6 load shedding is almost exponentially worse. It's not twice worse, it's 3 or 4 times worse. And I think that South African companies have always been resilient or remain resilient. And I think at stage 2 and 3 load shedding, companies manage just fine. We've learned to manage, we'll reschedule shifts, we'll make it up. But when it gets to 5 or 6, we've got real problems. Like, for example, Astral Chicken, you know, the way that's through its, the chickens got too big. They had to go back to the farms. Nobody wanted the big chicken. You know, you end up having a compounding issue when you get to level 6. So level 2 and 3, I think South Africans have learned to manage with, and I think we can cope with level 2 and 3. We just don't want to see level 6 again.
Turning to audience and questions, I've got a question in the front here. Just give me a show of hands. Okay, and over there. Great. Thank you.
Like this. Hi, David. Thanks for that very interesting talk. Your factors, when you look at filtering investment ideas, do you mind sharing a little bit of that?
Yeah, I think valuation is obviously always the most important. What is your entry level? I mean, if you buy something at the right price, again, you know, things can be priced in and downsides can be priced in. I mean, quality of management, I've referred to as well. And again, management teams that get it. I think there's still a lot of companies on the JSE where management are managing for themselves, not for shareholders. So shareholder alignment is obviously incredibly important. You know, we want them to do what's right for both them and us. Again, growing markets, all the good things that are there. But I think the management and the valuation are probably the two key points. If you buy right, and again, you know, just talking about management, that's another thing I perhaps missed. It's not just buying right, but it's selling right as well. You know, when a position gets to its maturity and gets to your target price, you need to have the discipline to sell it. And I think that's something that's incredibly important. A lot of people miss. Once it's in the portfolio, it's in. You need to keep checking. Is it at fair value? If it is at fair value, you know, we've got a saying in our company, we should never have anything at fair value. We need something that's got upside. If it's at fair value, we sell it, we put the money back into cash, and we wait for the next opportunity. That sure as night follows day will happen in the next few days or weeks. You know, so again, buying the right price, management, and also selling at the right time.
David, thanks for that, and congrats on the performance. You mentioned management a lot. Just a word on your engagement, shareholder activism in this country, and perhaps I think you were involved in the Fortress story and how that played out. It was quite unusual that they couldn't work it out, but you guys could work it out.
Yeah, I mean, Thanks for that. I mean, I think that is absolutely a demonstration of a win-win. You know, whether you have the A's or the B's, just to give someone some context, Fortress is a property company, had an A and a B class shareholder, and the rights were somewhat different to both classes. And there was a bit of a standoff through COVID. The company's income fell and it didn't make its sort of targets and it couldn't pay a dividend. So it ended up being derated. So you almost had a stalemate between the A and the B shareholders to try and find a way forward for this company. And again, Justin, my colleague, championed this, went to all the major shareholders, the A shareholders and the B shareholders, and got something together that ended up being a fantastic win-win. You look at the returns on the A's, you look at the returns on the B's, you know, and again, it's a company with still great value unlocking potential. So we out the B's because we got redeemed with the Nepi Rockcastle, but we're still pretty big shareholders in the A's. You know, again, we really like that. We like the team. We think there's scope for more value unlock. And, you know, I think it took Justin probably 100 iterations, you know, talking. The company said, you have to show us, you have to demonstrate the support to us before we're going to put out another circular. There was a failed deal a year or 18 months ago. And of course, you were left with a management team and shareholders who were fighting with each other. So you needed to find a win-win situation. And again, just using some common sense and demonstrating to each party what it meant for them and how it was good for both parties, eventually got that over the line. But a lot of hard work, but a wonderful prize at the end of the day.
Is there enough shareholder activism in South Africa?
I think you need to be careful. I mean, nobody really wants to go out there and pick fights. I think that's quite... I mean, there's easier ways to make money than to pick a fight. You know, I think, I mean, NASPA's process is one, for example, that certainly we've been engaging on for close to 7-8 years now. And again, the value destruction that's happened there in the core. But it just, you know, when you've got a control structure and somebody who's got the keys, sometimes it's just too big a fight to get in. You can only go so far. If people don't want to listen, well, they don't want to listen. We'd far prefer a Fortress-type situation where we had a management team that had a problem, their shareholders were fighting with them, and we could present a solution to both A and B shareholders as well as the management team, which just made a lot of sense for all the people. And I think having demonstrated, I mean, again, we obviously dealt with Coronation, the PIC, Investiga, every single asset manager out there, to demonstrate how this was a good transaction for everyone. And again, Nepi Rockcastle has been a wonderful asset and has kicked really nicely. So in fact, whatever anyone's got out of this deal has really been a fantastic win-win situation.
You mentioned Prosus Naspers. It's a theme again, the 10 cent side. You talk about the fact that there is value to be had in 10 cent. And you spoke about an 8-9% allocation to China. We were discussing earlier Alibaba, Baidu. Do those feature? I know there's no direct ownership. How do you get exposure to China?
So our exposure to Tencent is actually direct. We haven't gone through Naspers and Prosus. Again, you know, we watched the value destruction there. I mean, I think they bought the last deal they did, they bought a company of, I think, 5 or 6 billion, and they've already written it off by two-thirds. I mean, you know, we can't sit and watch this. There's a discount there, and a fair, it's narrowed, which is quite nice, but, I mean, a fair amount of that discount is justified by value-destructing deals by the core management team that still think that they're in, you know. Again, don't confuse luck with genius. You got 10 cent right many years ago. Just leave it. I think since then, I don't think there's any other massively value-enhancing deal that core team have done. So we're going through Tencent Direct. We bought Tencent Direct. Another one we've got in China is a company called Pindodo, which is an interesting one. It'll be interesting to know in the audience here, who have you bought off Temu recently, who have sort of come into this country?
Here we go. You've actually bought off Temu.
Yeah. Quite an interesting story. I mean, certainly, you know, they really are sweeping the board. I mean, they've got up to, in America, 70% of Amazon's penetration in 3 years. So, you know, it is running the boards in Europe as well, and obviously launched in South Africa. there's delivery into South Africa. I've certainly bought probably too many packages from them in the last 4 or 5 months. The stuff comes in 8 or 9 days. You pay a bit of duty, probably between 8% and 14% of the value. But quite a nice product range, and certainly generally pretty happy with what they've been giving us. And the way that they work is they're backwardly integrated into these factories. So they really are getting the best possible price. And it is fantastic, the prices that you get there, and it's delivered to your house. So yeah, with no additional fee.
Just tell me the name of the Chinese company.
Pindodo.
Pindodo. Yeah. Is this direct access to Temu?
Yes. No,
so it is?
Yes.
Pindodo.
Yeah.
Right. I know in our last session, a number of people left the room when we discussed the 5 stocks to speak about in South Africa. I can see some of the trades now, being
if you look
today.
At Pindodo, it's a bit of a wild ride. I mean, it's sort of the risk is that Trump gets in and bans, you know, all the direct Chinese delivery stocks. But I think they've got enough of a model both in China and Europe and the rest of the world. And I think their product range is probably unique enough, cheap enough, and interesting enough that even if the U.S. business sort of disappears or Trump shuts it out, it's probably still worth what it, you know, there's still upside in the valuation at the moment.
Other geographies?
We've got an interesting company in Sweden. It's called Evolution Gaming. It runs virtual casinos. Literally dealers sitting with cameras on live casinos, and obviously with the rise in online gaming, they're tapped into there. Quite an interesting, not so easy to do, and they have these sort of halls full of these dealers dealing either blackjack or roulette or other games. So quite an interesting company. In Europe, that's probably and we've got a little bit of exposure in Poland retail. But that's, you know, our main exposures are actually in the U.S. at the moment.
Your main exposures are in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Elaborate.
Well, we've got MasterCard, we've got Visa, we've got our Meta that we've held on. And again, Meta, if we go back, talking about that stop loss, you know, a year, 18 months ago, Meta was that stock. Meta was that stock at sub $100. Where, you know, there was a red light flashing and we sat down and looked at it. Again, we looked at the situation. Now, we didn't double up, which was clearly was the mistake we made, but we were lucky enough we did held on. At that time, we were worried that perhaps Zuckerberg would just continue to put more and more money into the metaverse. It would disappear. But there was, again, a sign maybe 3 or 4 months after it hit the lows, when he started to cut costs, he started to refine his business to start understanding, perhaps acting a little bit more commercially, particularly on the metaverse, where that was the spark to sort of take it up. And we took a few more, probably about 30 or 40% higher. But again, obviously been a sort of 4 or 5 bagger since then.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Just a question, please, on the, I don't know if it's a proliferation. There are 2 or 3 extra stock exchanges now in South Africa, in addition to the JSE. 1 or 2 of them came about for regulatory reasons to list sort of empowerment shares. The future of the JSE, your comment, and possible future of these new smaller stock exchanges for capital raise or just trading in a better, cheaper manner than dealing with the JSE.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. The JSE as a capital raising mechanism is really kind of not functioning at the moment. I mean, it isn't providing what it should do to small entrepreneurial businesses that want to bring their business. Now, how much of that is cyclical and how much of that is structural? Well, it's probably a bit of both, unfortunately. But there's no doubt that if you speak to small and mid-cap companies, there's not one of them that wants to be listed right now. And almost without fail, that almost all rather be unlisted than listed, which is a real problem. And I think the JSE need to look at that. They need to find ways to cut the cost of listing. As far as the other stock exchanges are concerned, we've never really dealt with them. We've never really, you know, perhaps some of the brokers we go through may tap them to try and find liquidity and we don't know about it. But generally, we still deal with our mainline stockbrokers who predominantly are playing on the JSE. And just another point there, one of the other things, if I go back 15, 20 years, the stockbrokers used to have a very substantial, or generally very substantial analyst teams, some of who were really good. But if I look now with disintermediation and brokerage being cut, those what we would call sell side, the analysts are disappearing, and really the sell side as being a source of good investment recommendations is really almost extinct right now. And again, for a business that's got an in-house research capability, that's exactly what we want. We don't want other clever people telling lots of other people what they think, what they should be doing. We'd rather generate that ourselves. So that's another thing that's been changed over. I can certainly remember at Liberty in the early days of Peregrine Capital, listening to probably, you know, 15, 20 sell-side analysts who, if they would phone me, I would take their call and listen to what they have to say, because I knew they added value to me. If I speak to 4 or 5 analysts a year, not a year, but 4 or 5 people that I would engage with over the year, it's probably really only 4 or 5.
Go ahead.
David, so over the two days, we've had about 4, I think, asset managers speaking. And you were saying at the start, you guys are a little bit more pragmatic with regards to asset classes. If the thing can make money, we'll invest in it. The thing that's been making the most money in the last 13 years is Bitcoin. So the standard answer we've had is that I don't understand it, but given the cleverness of everyone on stage, I don't suspect that's quite true. So Bitcoin and gold, your opinion?
Gold, I mean, again, I think with gold, it's almost binary. You're either a fan or you're not. I'm not really a massive fan of gold. On Bitcoin, you know, I need a job to be here. You know, he's our Bitcoin expert. And certainly he makes a very strong case that, particularly with what's happened recently, that Bitcoin is, I mean, a number of our analysts do hold Bitcoin personally, and they've got a fair percentage of their wealth in Bitcoin. So I think it's something that we cannot ignore. We need to watch. We need to learn. Perhaps I'm a little bit more old school and need a little bit more convincing than they do, but it is an active debate in our firm at the moment.
Go ahead.
David, you mentioned the Meta. I would love to know your views on the metaverse, virtual reality, online gaming.
Yeah, well, I think some of the stuff is incredibly clever. And I think at the moment, obviously, Meta's getting a rating now, you know, to be kind of an AI company as well. I mean, it's moved with the AI companies. But, I mean, the metaverse is still for us a little bit of a black box. Some very clever stuff. The practicalities of which are incredibly difficult to sort of quantify right now. When you've got an entrepreneur like Zuckerberg throwing proper money at this thing, you have to think he's going to stumble on something quite interesting. But I'm not sure there's anything there that you could really put massive valuations on at the moment. So for us, let's see what comes out. There's lots of interesting stuff there. He's not wasting his money. He really does think that he can get something that is practical. It's coming out. It's moving quickly, but it's difficult to really quantify, you know, how valuable that will be over the medium term.
You spoke about the powerful position to be able to short Tesla. Sai shared his view on Tesla. I asked him whether he was getting emotional. He denies that. How do you feel about Tesla? Is this something we should be shorting?
We're kind of not brave enough on the US market to short too much at the moment. And in fact, if we look at where we are right now, it's, you know, we have very little individual short positions in shares. And I guess in the South African case, it's because, you know, markets are generally pretty depressed. On the offshore side, we've got a small short in Apple as well. So we're on the same page there. But on Tesla, we don't have a short. I mean, again, you know, there's sort of spirit forces that can move these markets. And again, with not being that close proximity to it, you know, would we not short Tesla? We've never owned it, and we've never been shorted.
Are there any other questions in the room? I've got, if we could get a microphone just passed back, that's brilliant. Thank you so much. Go ahead.
Thank you, David. You mentioned EFF, ANC, not your base case. What is your base case and how does political risk factor into your process, if at all? And are you buying calls or puts on the rand at these levels?
Yeah, so I like your question, if at all. I mean, I think when I first started out with Peregrine Capital, you know, I was sort of fixated on markets, going home, putting on CNBC, what's the Dow doing, how are we doing? I think over time, as long as you've got companies that you researched well, that you put into the portfolio at the right price, that have decent management teams and good moats and are generating cash, the kind of rest of the stuff about interest rates and economic factors are a little bit of noise. Now, obviously, the election is really front and center. So I've had two interactions with the deputy president probably over the last 9 months. You know, and the first interaction, you know, he told me that the natural party would be the DA, which is the second party and easier to deal with, and of course, a week later, the press was filled with the EFF being his sort of prize candidate. So it is very difficult to call. I don't think it's callable right now. I think we're in a game of bridge right now where everyone's hands are going to be dealt with the election. And I think once everybody picks up their hand post the election, we're actually going to see where everybody actually sits. And nobody's making any of those decisions right now. I just look at what the ruling party is doing subliminally. And again, by appointing Michelle Phillips as the CEO of Transnet, by embracing capitalism, by embracing joint ventures, bringing the private sector in, that they must see that that is their only way out of the situation they've got right now. I don't see it going more left. I see it going more right. I see it, you know, that they've got to realize that that is the only way they're going to get service delivery up. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we're back to Johannesburg tomorrow, but I think we're going to need like a week of rehab. We haven't seen a pothole down here in a week. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. And hats off to, we haven't seen a piece of paper. I mean, it just shows you what is achievable.
And semigration is going to continue.
Yeah. Sorry, we're resisting that one at this stage.
So a final question from my side. You're 25 years, celebrating 25 years of Peregrine. You've got an outstanding track record. And I go back to the Pure Hedge Fund. It is a compound annual return of 19% since 1998. You've got your growth fund, also hedge fund, which is a compound annual growth rate of 23% since 2000. If I said to you there was only one geography that you could invest in, where would it be?
Again, you need to give me a time frame. So when I'm bullish on South Africa, at this point in time, I see South Africa as a trade. So with where we are at the moment, now that may morph into something that is a longer term scenario. But at the moment, things are too cheap. Therefore, if it runs 20 or 30%, we'll be on the exit thing. But if it runs 20 or 30% because we have a great outcome in the election, we're seeing things come together, we're embracing the private sector, we're moving on in privatization, then we've got a different scenario. Then it is an investment and something that can run for years and years and years off such a low base.
So right now, though, your South Africa play is short term.
Correct.
If I said to you, you've got a 3-year horizon and one geography, what would it be?
I'd probably still take South Africa right now, where we are. I mean, I would probably think that if you've got a decent manager, I mean, you look at the resilience of our management teams, they just eke it out. Whatever you throw at them, they eke it out, you know?
I think we'll close on that positive note. I like the fact that we're going with a glass half full as we leave this room, rather than a glass half empty.
You're good.